Welcome to Local Matters. I am back in the studio with Myla Mason, country music legend, who I had the opportunity to talk to a couple of weeks ago, and we thought that that was going to be part one of two, and that part two would have occurred about a week ago, but so much has been going on in your life in the past week that I think listeners are going to want to hear about, and it sort
starts
with basically the idea that you're starting a record label and what you're going to be doing alongside your daughters and your son musically. So tell us all about that.
Well, we have the kids have been singing for years, and Kip, my son, is quite a young producer, up and coming kid that we call them kids. Anybody under 50 is considered
right.
a kid.
Yeah.
So he really is great at what he does. And he is a classical guitarist and has been studying production and doing production alongside his friend Nathan for years. And so we've decided to, instead of trying to shop the girls for a little record deal, the two young ones, that we're just going to set one up in place of kind of like a home, kind of how Rounder Records started out and all the little mom and pop record labels that you hear about. It's just such a nice time in the music business where you don't have to have big major support because the internet, like we were talking, has allowed streaming and releases of records, and you can actually send your singles out. And that's what we thought we would do. We would let them send out their music and let the market decide where they were going to be. And then if a major record label wanted to pick them up, we'd be cool with that. Who wouldn't? But we would also like them to have the versatility that they have, the music that they make. My son has been writing music and playing guitar for 5 hours a day since he was like 14, 15. He was on the bus with me. And he just really has studied and worked hard at it. And the melodies and things he's writing might not fit like the country music genre. Everybody keeps saying, what is this? What is this? And to me, that's a good thing, because I've always liked stylists. When I hear someone's voice, if it's recognizable. And I think too many times, a long time ago, artists didn't have to be pegged into one position, or stuck, put that square peg in that square,
Yes.
So the internet and everything has opened it up to where you can, it's more of a single driven atmosphere right now, where you can release a song that sounds like it's traditional country, or one that's more, pop sounding, or one that's a little techno sounding. So the kids get to explore all these great sounds that they write anyway. The kids will go from singing, Rain and May will go from singing something written, I kid you not. And I think TikTok has inspired a lot of this. Songs from the 40s. And they'll say, Mom, do you know what this is? Are songs from the Beach Boys. And then they'll turn right around and sing Tammy Wynette.
Yeah.
So that's the way kids are listening now. So releasing singles one at a time, that we don't try to make the sound fit into a box that we may never, ever get in. And a lot of people have careers right now where they're not on major record labels. So going the indie mom and pop record label way is kind of what I've always wanted to do. That's my dream.
Yeah.
So that I get to have my first act on there be my kids, who I adore.
I've been studying music and the music business on some level for years, but mostly music itself. And you and I have talked about this before, that I finally gave up on American press altogether when it came to looking for music, whether it's old or new music. And I read only British press, and somebody made a point a long time ago of saying, the greatest purveyor of American blues in the United States all came from England. You had the Beatles, you had the Stones, you had Led Zeppelin at some point. There were all these British guys that were looking at music that we had kind of forgotten about. And mind you, Elvis did a great job of taking that sound and putting it into his musical career in a way that turned the music industry and changed culture and society altogether. That really was the birth of what we could have called rock and roll in the United States. But, in looking at music business now, I've noticed that the model has changed so drastically, and I feel like you've been ahead of the curve for a long time and are starting to work with people that have been ahead of the curve the entire time. And the weird thing about the coronavirus, as you and I have talked, is it's not just a plague. It's a great opportunity to rethink how we're all going to handle our lives in the future, so that, you know, you and the various people you've been talking with are already on that game and have something prepared in a way that means that your daughters and your son and perhaps some of your, you know, music you had can be marketed in a completely different way. And it ties in with something I've always been crazy about, and that is listening to music on vinyl.
Right.
And so many young artists know that maybe the only way they can make money at all is to just release their music on vinyl. And now, weirdly, there's been this a recent uptick in the production of cassettes. And I noticed originally there was a DJ that had picked up Beastie Boys albums and done these remixes, right, that were cassette only,
right,
available. And
you can find so many times when young songwriters come to me, and young artists, they'll ask me, you know, how do you know something's a hit? And I said, well, go listen to old vinyl, because every song on there they thought was going to be a single, or it had reason for being on there. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to it, it's stuff that never hit the radio, but it's just as worthy.
Right.
You know, because one of their songs might have stayed on the charts for weeks and weeks and weeks, where they could only release two or three singles. But you know, they thought like 10 of them, you know, they were like, which 10 should we put on here? So they were all important. I said, go listen to the songs you never heard that are buried in Goodwill. You know, go to the records and the vinyls, and go buy yourself a record player and listen to those old records that had different singles on there that were never released. And then you'll see that you can write outside the box, that there's great things out there to find. You could cover some of this older stuff, you know, that hasn't. I just love finding secret songs that have been put in little coffins.
I'm you know? The exact same way. I'm in the studio today with country music legend Myla Mason, who most people would immediately think of as a country music singer, but the reality is you are very much a country music and music songwriter. You write some classics that could be recorded and produced in a way that sound like country, or could be a pop standard, you know. And what some listeners may or may not know is that I have signed on as the executive producer for your music, your daughter's and your son's music. And I've always said, if I had some extra money to executive produce another album, I would love to go back and take a look at songs that you recorded that were big hits for you on the country charts and re-record those in the studio using orchestration, you know.
Oh, Luke. And I would love to do that.
You know, when you think about Patsy Cline and how her career emerged as a person that was on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry, but with these beautiful, lush orchestrations.
Owen Bradley.
There was Owen Bradley.
Took over producing her and put on all those great strings and those arrangements.
Yes. Yeah.
It was amazing.
It was.
It's amazing to me what production can be and what it can do. And Stephen Curtis Chapman, the great Christian artist, he shows on one of his records, I think it's a live production of This Is How His Song Would Have Sounded, recorded like this, bluegrass, like from Paducah, Kentucky, where he's from. And this is how it would have sounded if it had been recorded this way. And this is how it would have sounded. And he takes one song and shows it. And it's right. You know, things, some songs you can't. Like,
yes, no.
You can't do that with.
Right.
But a lot of songs, you can produce them in different ways. But that's part of the fun of creating. There's so many avenues in making a record, you know, your production sound, your arrangements, the words. But you can take a great, just like the example, Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You became this big Whitney Houston smash on The Bodyguard.
Yeah.
And after that, Stella, her sister, was working her catalog, and they had to start updating like some of her old demos and stuff and getting it all ready, because all of a sudden everyone in the world wanted a Dolly Parton. Everyone knew what a great songwriter Dolly Parton was, you know, especially in Nashville. Everybody loved her music for, you know, 20, 30 years. But then all of a sudden there was this pop sound that came out with one of her great country songs. I Will Always Love You was a country masterpiece.
It was.
And then it became this big Whitney Houston song. Right. And it's iconic, you know, and they're all there. You can go back and listen to all kinds of country songs. They're just so well crafted. I'm not talking about myself as an A&R person. When I was listening for years, I did A&R when I left Atlantic Records for different acts, from everyone from helped launch the Rascal Flatts.
Yes.
Got their developmental budget. Then got to work with Rob Galbraith and Ronnie Millsap, who are just amazing. You know, like they didn't need my help. They had had so many number one records, but listening for him was one of my greatest joys. And because I would listen for 8 hours to other people's music. So I became this big fan of other songwriters. And what I realized was songs could be written 20 years ago and still had that magic that had never found their way out of those song coffins.
Right.
There's a lot of great hits out there waiting to be heard.
One of
the things, thank goodness for the internet.
There's a little bit of genius in you that I know you'd be reluctant to accept as a compliment, but I have to say it anyhow. And that's the fact that you have learned how to combine the business of creativity with business and how to make, you know, money at it. And I met you years ago before you were a big country music star.
Thank you.
And you had come to New York, and there's a whole story that we told in our last get together. And I think we've got easily 4 or 5 more sessions that you and I could be in the studio and talk about. And we have a lot that I think the public is going to be interested in. But when you had left New York City and gone on back to Nashville, and you were starting to explode on the country charts, I was in New York, and I'd started a group called ASAP, A-S-A-P, mm-hmm. and it stood for Artist Supporting Artist Priorities. And our primary objective was, how do we make a living as artists? Because if you go to school to study for art, there's not a business program generally at art schools. And if you go to a school that has a great business administration program and you're getting a degree in business, you don't know how to apply that to art necessarily.
How do they meet?
And it takes somebody having the drive and the determination and the innate built-in knowledge that I've got to combine the two of these if I'm going to make a living as an artist. You know, you can pursue the dream.
And that's what you set up with your foundation.
Exactly.
Where you each, and that's what we should do, is bridge each other. When I started recording on Atlantic Records, first of all, I felt so like I was just didn't want to mess up. You know what I mean? I was like, this is my shot, because it came so later in life that I was like, oh, okay, I've got this record deal.
You say later in life, and that's one of the things I think listeners need to hear, is that there are people that have these so-called late in life successes that that people don't often expect to happen.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back in the studio with Myla Mason.
What's so important about shopping with locally owned businesses?
When you shop local, your hard-earned dollars stay here in the community, helping to benefit your friends and neighbors, local schools, roads, and all aspects of community life.
But what happens to my money if I spend it online or at a national chain store?
In most cases, the profits go far away, out of state, corporate headquarters, or even overseas.
It doesn't take any extra effort to shop local. Office Mart on South Jefferson and Cookeville is your locally owned office furniture and supply store. For over 35 years, they've been proud to serve businesses in the Upper Cumberland with quality and value. You get real customer service, too. And unlike shopping online, you can actually see and try out the large inventory of office furniture in their showroom. And when it's delivered, it's not a box on your step. They're glad to install and set up everything. Office Mart. There's no other locally owned office store in the region. South Jefferson Avenue across from Hardee's. Shop local at Office Mart.
We're back in the studio for Local Matters with country music legend Myla Mason, and you were just talking about what you called a late in life success that you weren't expecting to happen. So for you, you hit the country charts when you were...
In my 30s, yeah. And everyone, I had been in all-girl groups with like Dina Carter and Rhonda Hart, and I got all my friends went on and they were Tracy Berg. You know, they all went on and had record deals or were signed songwriters way before me. And I just kept thinking, there's not enough room. All my friends have made it. Why would I? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I did get my record deal, Blake Mevis, who produced George Strait and Keith Whitley and Vern Gosden, all these greats, when I did get my record deal, he sat me down and said, look, you need to know everything about what you're doing. This is how much a production budget is. This is how much you need to spend. And so having a great mentor, usually if you learn something, you know, from someone, it's because they're great teachers. You know, and he sat me down and said, you need to learn this. So the day that I hit my radio tour, where they send you out to talk to the radio stations and try to get your record played, I asked the radio promoters the very first day, I'm like, how do the charts work? I learned to ask questions. And the best part was everyone, it seemed like in the music business, from radio guys to producers, were willing to share their knowledge. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I never had that kind of artist thing where I wanted to be on stage. Does that make sense? Where I
know,
just, yeah. Please give me the spotlight, that kind of thing.
Right.
I never had that. I always wanted to create music.
Yeah.
So
it's as if singing really was just an outlet for what you had written.
It was because it was funny. Whenever I went into the first, like some of my radio interviews, they weren't getting what I was saying and they had to do a second take. They were like, you know, because I would say to them, I didn't get any songs on my record and I was sleeping with the artist, meaning myself,
right.
You know? And so I had to change that around a
right.
bit too.
Yeah.
I had to learn how to talk a little bit
right.
better without sounding like I'd done something wrong. What I was saying was that, I worked really hard to be a songwriter. And that was what was important to me. And it was just as important to me to hear other people singing my music. I actually got a bigger thrill when I would hear someone else sing a song of mine. You know, Ty Herndon cut a song of mine called Stained Glass Window. And when he sang it, I was pregnant whenever they sent me a copy of it with Rainey. And he sent me a copy of it and I just burst into tears. It was like, oh, I still will do it thinking about it.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Just to hear someone else. It's like knowing someone read your book.
Yeah.
But there's all these moments that you get given gifts of, and you always think if you plan them that they're going to be huge, big
yeah.
moments, and they're not.
Yeah.
It's the things that suddenly all that work that you put into something, it comes back to you.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, and that's the thing I think that gets overlooked by so many people in life. There's so many opportunities for gratitude on a daily basis, and that also includes hardship. And that's one of the
right.
lessons I think you learned a long time ago. I learned a long time ago is gratitude for everything.
Everything.
You know, and complaining just gets you nowhere in life. And you know, the powers that be are just going to reflect that. The more you complain, the more you're just going to be handed stuff to complain about.
And that's the thing is it doesn't matter. You can be digging ditches or you can be recording music. There's hardly anyone I've ever met that had success that didn't go through valleys.
Right.
You know, and usually after they have success, they go through valleys. So
right.
sometimes we have to be grateful for the crap that we go through
yeah.
or we wouldn't be able to handle valleys because they're coming. Everyone
yeah.
gets one.
Yeah.
You know, and anyway, but I did enjoy learning about the music business from great mentors. And I did have valleys after having huge success,
sure. yeah.
you know, of where I was like, okay. And you know what? That Patsy Cline movie, watching her, you know, ironing clothes and
yes.
being pregnant and being mad and
yeah.
hearing songs on the radio
yeah.
when she was off. We all go through times.
You recognize that character in
oh,
yourself, did you not?
Very much. I was working two jobs after. When I left Atlantic Records, I left and left my publishing deal at the same time. Because I had an 8-album contract and I wanted to write my music. That's what I came here for. I wanted my songs on the radio. So I left with all intentions of coming back, you know, of bringing my record back to them.
Yeah.
But I left. And then at that time, Atlantic Records closed down its doors. But I did finish that record. And that was my favorite that I ever did because it was truly me. It was my words, my thoughts, my songs that had 3 or 4 people, you know, each character in the song or the
Absolutely.
Story songs would have 3 people I knew, real people in that character. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was important to me to get that done.
Yeah. And I think that what we'll realize about 20 years from now is you're going to look back and say it's sort of the same thing about what's coming up right now. You know,
yeah.
you and I are always sort of 1 foot in the future and we realize that we're embarking on a journey together that listeners have heard a little bit about, and it's a combination of the fact that I'll be executive producing music for you, but that you and I are going to also be working on starting initially online with a space and a venue called Upstairs
at Harper's.
And Harper's is a reference to the name of my rare bookstore and collectible store, which includes a lot of vinyl record albums. When I say a lot, it's something like 2,000 vinyl record albums, mostly jazz, but a lot of great rock and roll and things that listeners can come into. We're going to have the old-fashioned listening booths where you take an album and sit down and have a listen to it. And upstairs from that, you and I are going to be launching something together where you will be showcasing writers and singers, starting with your 2 daughters and son.
And son, Kip. Rain and May. Yeah.
Rain and May.
Rain and May. And they've been singing together for years. And I'm just excited about all of it, that the kids will be performing there and that we'll have other people come in and perform there. The kids, Rain and May, Rain's 18 and May's 13, and they've been singing together for years. And they just, we were talking about how full circle things are, right. Like our friendship.
Yes.
But a lot of the songs I wrote over the past 8 years were for other young female artists or for, there's always in the business side of writing music, there was always young girls that would come to me and say, will you help me write for this project? Or will you help me write for that? And I would write bunches of songs with them and they would use one or two.
Yes.
And so I had all this whole huge catalog of young girl songs, not knowing that my two babies knew every word to everything. You know what I mean? They could sing them better. They were in the rooms when we were writing, or they were, you know, they toddled around with me from the time they were little. So I'll go to pull something up out of my catalog and say, hey, do you guys want to, and they'll know, they can sing harmonies and know words to songs that I've written. I'm like, what is that? And Randy will go, oh, that was, you know, this is your song over here.
We talked about that the last time we were together, which was a couple of weeks ago, and we'd expected to be back in the studio last week. But as we said, a lot's been going on and I'm having trouble keeping up, and it's just great. But it's that whole attitude that you and I have had for years, which we joke about. You had made a reference before to the film Sweet Dreams with Patsy Cline, and you and I, in talking about creativity and work that we've done together and what we're doing in the future, very much resembles the old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies where, you know, somebody said, hey, my dad's got a barn, let's put on a show, you know. And whether you're in your 30s and having a breakout career in the music industry like you did, or me at 40, diving out of the fitness industry in order to pursue what I had dreamed of as a small child, and had called Charles Schulz on the phone to announce at age 7, which was, hey, Mr. Schulz, I want to be a cartoonist when I grow up. I don't know how I got his phone number, but, you know, I had to remind myself at about 40 that when I had turned 30, I had kind of said, you know, if I'm not going to write kids' books by 30, it's not going to ever happen. And just as I was pushing 40, I thought, why not?
Why not?
Why not just give it a shot at 40? And sure enough, for me, my late in life career started in my mid-40s as a children's book writer and illustrator. 3 books in a row, 1, 2, 3 in a row. And it was just a matter of keeping that attitude in my heart, which is, you know, I've got my own barn, which is my own heart.
Right.
I'm just going to go ahead and put on a show. I mean,
I've got my own barn.
You did promise Charles Schulz when you were 7 that you're going to be a cartoonist when you grew up. So you need to keep that promise, you know, to him. And I think that's kind of you. You know, you see yourself making promises to yourself along the way. And you had no idea that you'd have 2 daughters and a son that would have any interest in music at all. But there is something weird that we talked about last time, whether it's nature or nurture, but that there are musical families, you know. And the comparison I made was obviously with, you take Johnny Cash and you talk about the Carter family and how important they were and how that they all came together as a musical family, and how much talent, you know, went on from that for years to come. Roseanne Cash, you know,
right, Dina, I mean, all of them,
you know,
that came
you
from Maybelle Carter.
Your kids could have had no interest whatsoever, but somehow it's partly in their genes. And the thing, as I've said before about Kip, your son, is not just that he's a consummate musician and can play music incredibly well. He's a consummate professional when it comes to the business of, say, putting on a show and production and all of that, you know. And I was fortunate to have all of you at my wedding singing and performing. But the thing that I noticed was, you know, when you're doing a wedding, the craziness of keeping it together and how, what is going to happen when, and all you'd have to say to Kip is, this is what we want to do. And somehow Kip made it all come together in a great way.
He's a great producer, a great
really
director.
Is.
And I'm so proud of him because he does, all that was learned on his own. And I know he was in the environment of it, but you can take a child and set them at an instrument and say, play. And if they don't want to play, they're not going to play. Kip picked all that up on his own. He started playing Randy Rhoads, Ozzy Osbourne. He wasn't playing country music. You know what I mean?
That's
and
great.
And self-taught himself how to play the guitar, watching other people. But Randy Rhoads from Ozzy Osbourne is what he studied. And Randy was a classical musician, trained musician. So that's why Kip chose that path. And that he was around the music and being around country music and on buses and stuff, he saw how things worked. But production and music wise, his ear's been around all of everything. But he really spent like 5 hours a day. I couldn't get him to eat supper without the guitar being in his lap.
That's dedication,
you know?
Right there. You know,
he would eat breakfast with it. I'm like, oh my goodness. There were times I never thought I'd hear myself say, put that down, you know, but that's sometimes it came to that point.
Well, listeners are gonna have a a great chance to hear him and see him. And we'll talk about that in one of our next get-togethers. I hope you're planning on coming back again, and we can talk some more about this venue called Upstairs at Harper's, which is going to feature Myla Mason and Friends. That's sort of the name of the show, if you want to call it that for now. And again, it's just been a great opportunity, in addition to being a terrible tragedy, this business of the coronavirus, but the opportunity that's come out of it is something that is going to reverberate for years to come, I think. So thanks for being on the show, and we'll talk to you again hopefully in the next couple of weeks.